Welcome to John Powd's All the Rage here on www.trexfm.org. John presents part one of two interviews with Stacey Clear. Stacey is a stripper, performance artist, writer, activist, Buddhist, care worker and co-founding member of the East London Strippers Collective. She grew up in Northern England and began working as a stripper aged 22 in Scotland while on a gap year from her fine art degree at Glasgow School of Art. First club she worked in taught her that a strip club could be run respectfully and that stripping could be empowering, so long as the conditions were right. It wasn't long before she encountered conditions within the industry that were not empowering. She has worked all over the UK, Paris and Australia, and for her longest stint she danced at the White Horse in Shoreditch, London, a family business for 38 years. Stacey helped to co-found the East London Strippers Collective, www.ethicalstripper.com, as a concerted effort to unite dancers around common grievances about our own industry, including the poor representation of strippers in the public and the media. EOSC aimed to promote the self-organisation of strippers, lap dancers in London and the UK, and to challenge socialist society attitudes towards strip club activity by uniting performers, creating their own working conditions and empowering dancers. Stacey also gave a TEDx talk in 2015 with the book The Ethical Stripper, discussing her concerns. John, take it away.
All the Rage with John Bowd. www.trexfm.org.
Hello listeners, welcome again to All the Rage, and yet again I have a guest, which means not an hour of me ranting about something, which is good. Please introduce yourself.
Hi there, my name's Stacey Clare. I am a stripper, a writer, I'm an activist, and I'm a co-founding member of the East London Strippers Collective. And thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for inviting me. Tell me all about the mysterious world of clubs.
At strip clubs, yes. Well, so the business model of a strip club is kind of like, it comes from a period of time. It comes from an era when there was an awful lot of disposable income. So like, we're talking about kind of 90s, early 2000s, kind of boom time era. And this kind of period of like, you know, bankers' expenses and corporate entertainment and kind of lads mags and the ladettes, and it was kind of, you know, cool to be one of the guys. And and so we've got this business model now in this industry that's about like 15 years behind. Like, it's totally out of date because now we're, you know, in austerity and recession, and like, you know, we're seeing kind of just wealth disparity that like makes us kind of, you know, divide us into the haves and the haves nots. So so strip clubs run like a kind of marketplace, as in, so the workers, the dancers, we have to pay to work. So the first thing that happens when we go to get a job in a strip club is we have to pay a house fee. So you start your shift, you go and normally pay like just a house fee to the club. That can be anywhere between £20 up to £120, £130, depending on where the club is and how big it is and how many girls are working and the night of the week. And, you know, it's quite arbitrary, though. There's no rules about this. Then also, what we've seen introduced over the last kind of 5 to 10 years is commissions on top of that. So because clubs can monitor how much money we make from selling, you know, lap dancers and private dancers and going and sitting down with customers for like what's called a VIP, which can be like an hour or a couple of hours or the whole night we can spend with a customer just entertaining them, basically. And if that money, if the customer is paying the club, then that money is going through their card machine and the club can just take a cut if that's what they want to do. So we can see commissions now as well from 20% up to 60% in the worst cases.
What's the actual justification for that commission?
Because they can. There is no justification. They simply can.
Because this is not a properly regulated sector, would that be?
It is not regulated under employment law. It is regulated under like licensing law. So there are some controls over that, you know, conditions with the licenses, but none of that really goes into employment conditions for us.
Yeah.
So we're technically self-employed, or at least the clubs very much treat us like we're self-employed. Or actually, no, sorry, clubs classify us as self-employed, whereas in fact they treat us as employees. Mm. So after we've paid our house fee to the club, we then go around selling our time, right? Selling our labour. So we go from table to table, customer to customer, and we say, would you like a private dance? Would you like a lap dance? Would you like to simply just give me some money for my presence? That's the fun part, right? Because we're entertainers. So that money that a customer gives us comes, you know, it's ours, but as I've said, the clubs have kind of found ways to siphon off cuts and what they want.
Yeah.
So you've got your house fee, you've got your commissions, and what we also have is fines. So clubs can also fine us for all sorts of arbitrary rules like chewing gum or using our phone if we're in front of a customer or if we're 10 minutes late or missing a shift. I mean, again, there's no arbitrary, sorry, this is arbitrary, there's no rules, there's no legal kind of caps on any of this. So clubs can then charge anything from £10 to £150 for some kind of transgression from their list of house rules. The interesting thing is, right, this is what leads us into the kind of labour condition stuff. Clubs can make us sign contracts, right? Clubs are licensed premises, okay? So they've got conditions put on their licenses by local authorities. There was a big hoo-ha in 2009 with the Policing and Crime Act, which has changed the industry somewhat. I'll probably go into that a bit later. But conditions can be things like the clubs must give us showers to use and clean water to drink and lockers. And, you know, there has been some thought, some effort on the part of the licensing authority to consider our safety and security. But it's very superficial and it's very paternalistic. I mean, to kind of, there's almost like this weird kind of obsession with like hygiene, like we've got to have showers because of course none of us have got showers at home, have we? Like,
not to mention,
we've got to wash off. Yeah, we've got to wash off the grubby kind of, you know, the residue. I mean, it's just crazy.
Is there a health and safety element involved in any, in licensing laws?
Well, I mean,
I didn't cover that in my union work. So
I often joke about how clubs seem to be an industry that health and safety forgot. Mm. Like, you know, health and safety legislation applies to all workplaces, and yet somehow it very rarely is upheld in strip clubs. I mean, I've worked in some places where, you know, they should have come with an environmental health hazard warning or something. It's like, I think that goes partly with this sort of, you know, the kind of social attitudes and this kind of unwillingness for local authorities to get involved at a useful level. It would be useful to us if councils actually did inspect the health and safety of a club, but they generally don't. They would rather look at it from a kind of public, it's more about the effect it has on the local residential population. It's more about this kind of this idea that it's a zoning issue, you know. It's sex work, so it's a zoning issue, so it needs to be happening kind of out of the way, so it's not, you know, close to a school or a church or a, you know, public park. Like I say, I've worked in some really shady places that health and safety just didn't seem to like be a thing. And then, but I've also worked in some places that were very well run that did have fire escapes and fire extinguishers, and they do follow the codes of, it is licensing. I mean, licensing conditions is about, you know, you're a licensed premises, you have a kind of social obligation to uphold safe conditions. Our burning priority is to fight for worker status. So going back to these kind of lists of rules, so very often how clubs will give us a list of rules to sign, like a contract. Okay. So if I go and work in a new club, first of all, they've got to check that I've got ID and I've got, you know, the permission to work in this country, because that's another thing that licensing is very strict about now. They then, depending on the club, because, you know, the ones that are not very well run, as in they're the ones that don't have the health and safety, they'll just be like, whatever, you know, just get on with it. Mm. But the ones that are well run and doing things by the book will then give us this kind of quasi contract to sign, which is essentially a list of house rules, things like, you know, you need to work 4 nights a week, you need to wear this dress, you need to not do this. These are all the things you're not allowed to do, like chewing gum, like using a phone, and they're the ways that they can fine us, obviously, if we break those rules.
How often would you someone tell you what to wear, though? Or is that...
Depends on the club. Oh, I mean, okay. It's, again, it's, I'll go into this later, okay, but sure, it can be the club sees it as part of their brand, right? So they want us to look and behave a certain way, which, you know, is one part of it, but it's how they go about it that is the problem.
It's the issue, yeah.
So they give us this list of rules, and then they also make us sign a disclaimer saying, I accept that I'm self-employed, that I'm responsible for paying my taxes, that I'm, you know, this is all my own responsibility. Mm. And at that point, the club washes their hands of any responsibility and duty towards us as employees. Mm. Now, as we know from the rising problems in the gig economy and from other struggles that have been going on, for example, with Uber drivers, with the delivery, with the Pimlico plumbers, what we're seeing is people realising that they have something called worker status.
Yeah.
And this is what strippers, you know, we've actually been in the gig economy all along. We're probably actually like the original zero-hour contractors. Yeah. And those lists of rules, like, for example, telling us what to wear and how often to work and whether we're allowed to nominate someone else to do our job for us, This is all the meaty stuff. This is the juicy material that we are getting into now within our sort of trade union activism, because we've taken some of these contracts and shown them to the employment lawyers with the UVW, United Voices of the World, and they're looking at these contracts and they're saying, well, you actually got quite a strong argument for worker status here, and all it takes is for, you know, one or two of you to go and claim that you've got worker status and claim your rights that you're legally entitled to, because by law, if you have worker status, you're already entitled to holiday pay, you're already entitled to not be discriminated against, you're already entitled to not have to work more than 48 hours a week if you don't want to. You know, there's a whole load of things that workers, people with worker status, have the right to uphold. And I think this is where the clubs are still, I think they've got some catching up to do, because we're on the case, basically.
Yeah. Well, such places normally need a good push in order to make them catch up.
100%. I mean, I've often seen that, you know, clubs are only run the way that legislation allows. You know, they're under no obligation to do things correctly until the law comes along and says, oh, Absolutely. Actually, you know, these are your legal obligations. And we have seen, as far as I know, at least only one serious claim of a stripper taking Peter Stringfellow to court, to the employment tribunal, actually, and arguing that she had employee status, and therefore she... So what happened was, she worked for Stringfellow for a long time. Drama, she got sacked unfairly. Obviously, she was furious about this. There was a lot of spurious reasons. And so she thought, fuck it, I'm going to talk to a lawyer. So she ended up with some of the biggest, like, barristers in the country working for her pro bono, because they were just like, great, good for their career, for their CV. And she tried to take Peter Stringfellow to the employment tribunal. So first of all, they went there, and it took, I mean, she literally spent 4 years of her life on this legal case. Mm. I've met her, we've spoken, she's an amazing woman, and I think she's a bit of a hero, to be honest. She lost first, and then appealed, and won at appeal, and then Stringfellow appealed that decision, and she lost. And then she tried to take it to the, I think it's the Supreme Court, was the one above the appeal court, Supreme Court.
So, yeah.
And they threw it out. Because, and everyone told her at the time, it was for political reasons. Because if that case, if she'd won, and that was like case law, then that test case would have opened up a massive can of worms across the whole country. And of course, we can't have, you know, women empowering themselves by claiming unfair dismissal, women who use their sexuality for, you know, capital to make money. We can't have, you know, we can't have them doing well out of it.
That would be terrible.
Yeah, so that was very much a kind of, you know, a stumbling block in the evolution of kind of, you know, female empowerment. So, but she did, you know, she did make a noise. And the thing was, though, in that case, that she was arguing, and I don't really know why, perhaps it was a reflection of the time, that she was arguing that she had employee status. So it was found, you know, after a lot of, they really did just kind of unpack the definition of employee. But at that time, had she argued that she had worker status, she probably would have won. But I think this worker status is actually something that's just kind of, people are kind of catching up with now because of the rise of the gig economy. And that was, you know, that court, that case was 2008 to 2012.
Yeah.
So it's already, you know.
But also there's been changes in tribunal law, hasn't there?
Yeah, I think so.
Less access for people to actually get to tribunals, which clashes, which of course was subsequently found to be illegal and overturned. So there's a lot going on there.
There is a lot going on.
Yeah. John Bouts, all the rage, all the on Trax FM, Trax FM, Trax FM.
Love for all of us, that we know.
all got a bit heavy into the trade union stuff already.
that's the main thing I'm here for. Which brings us beautifully to a little organisation called the East London Strippers Collective.
Yes.
Tell me all about that.
Well, so I started dancing in 2006, which was just as the credit crunch was hitting. And in 2008, in the middle of the global economic crisis, there was a bill proposed, the Policing and Crime Act, and there was a big debate about strip clubs at that time. It goes back to 2004, so you have to go back to the Licensing Act, which was Tony Blair's big idea, wasn't it? You know, Gordon Brown, boost the nighttime economy, Licensing Act, relax the licensing laws, boost the nighttime economy, woo, party time, 24-hour drinking. You know, it was very, and there was, and we did see this, you know, boom time. So during the mid-noughties, there were, I remember, because I was living in Scotland, a lot of pubs opening up with public entertainment licenses, venues doing live music, you know, bands and late licenses, and it was heaving. And during that period, strip clubs were opening up because there was a kind of loophole. Mm. A lot of strip clubs were opening up with a public entertainment license. So a PE license is a very easy license to go and get from your local authority. You simply just rock up and say, give me one, here's the money. Yeah. And because the licensing objectives are quite, they've relaxed them. So, you know, there was a boom in the industry. There were strip clubs kind of opening up all over the country. I think like one was opening up every week. There was, I mean, I remember working an opening weekend in this strip club in Middlesbrough, which was like, I mean, I've got my own personal feelings about who should have the right to run a strip club, and there are definitely some people who should not have, you know, should not be running a strip club. Because essentially, you have to go even further back and look to the 90s when lap dancing arrived in the country. It kind of was imported from America.
Yeah.
You used to get, there was always strippers, there's always been striptease entertainment for a long, long time, but that was always like a naked person on a stage, right? This idea of the lap dance very much comes from the States, and it arrived in the UK during the 90s with Peter Stringfellow and Spearmint Rhino, and there was a, there's another story in there about how those clubs were paying waivers to the local licensing authority. To, it was called like a nudity waiver. So like they could basically, just basically giving a backhander to the council to run a lap dancing club. Mm. And so then Licensing Act 2004, suddenly everything relaxes, suddenly strip clubs are opening up all over the country. And because of that business model of, okay, lap dancing attracted a lot of attention and it was a huge industry and there was a lot of customers willing to spend a lot of money on hot girls, basically, in their laps. So that's where the business model came from, because it was the clubs going, right, well, we'll just take a cut of what you earn. You're clearly making the money, but you just pay us a fee to work in our club, and that's the way it is. But that business model, if it's not, like, if it's inherently exploitative, if the workers don't have protections, if they don't actually have, if they're not recognised by law as workers and having certain legal rights, like the right to claim for unfair dismissal or the right to claim for, you know, sick pay or holiday pay. Like, it's all well and good if everyone's making money and it's fine and the money's just falling out of the sky and you can just, you know, oh, you lose your job somewhere, you just walk somewhere else, that's fine.
Yeah.
So out of that period grew this culture of just like the Wild West, you know, get away with whatever, it's fine, you know, everyone's happy, everyone's making money. 2004, clubs are opening up everywhere, and this is where the feminists come in. I should say the radical left, the sex worker exclusionary radical feminists, as in I'm a feminist, so I don't identify feminists as the problem, but there is a group of feminists that believe that the sex industry is only and can only ever be an expression of the patriarchy, a manifestation of patriarchal power, and therefore it must be stamped out at all costs. So that's when you had, we saw groups like Object and the Fawcett Society and the Women's Support Project, and a lot of organisations basically began lobbying. So they really wanted to see a stop to this kind of spread of lap dancing clubs. They didn't want to see lap dancing clubs advertised on sides of buses or on taxis or in the street, or, you know, they very much saw this kind of, oh, it's on our high street, it's ruining our children's lives. You know, it's a really bad thing for young girls to aspire to be lap dancers. We'll just get into that later on. But so, basically, they made a massive fuss, went to Parliament. 2008 is the year that there was a big debate in the House of Parliament. I think it was the Culture, Media and Sport Committee. This is when I was a student, by the way, and I'd been dancing for 2 years by this point. So it's a very long-winded answer to how did the East London Strippers Collective start. Okay, well, this is why.
This is chapter one.
It's a big, long story behind it. But so 2008, I'd been stripping for 2 years. I see this debate happening in Parliament, and I'm like, what? Where's the dancers? Who's asking the dancers? Like, you had people going to that committee, like Peter Stringfellow, like Simon Waugh. The people representing the industry were the bosses, the managers, the club operators, and without really accepting that we had a voice and a kind of role in it, like the whole thing. I mean, you know, there was a lot of gutter press around it at the time. There was a lot of tabloidy kind of, oh, lap dancing's gonna get banned, and it wasn't like a serious, no one really kind of came to us with a sort of serious kind of consultation, like, you know, what do you think, what do you need, how would you run the businesses better, what, you know, how would you like to see this kind of exploitation stopped? And the thing that really got up my fucking nose, really, that grinds my gears, is that there was this group called the Lap Dance Association that were not actually an association of lap dancers. They were an association of club bosses and managers with a few lap dancers in there for like show. And I think it was the secretary from this association was invited to give testimony in Parliament at this, you know, hearing. And she said something like, oh, well, of course, you know, if you want to talk to one of our girls, then, you know, that can be arranged. And I was just, what? Like, I was reading the transcript thinking, you're talking about us as if we're chattel property. You're talking about us like that's the fucking patriarchy right there. Mm. So I wrote my dissertation, got first, having basically sat down and done all this research into licensing legislation, I concluded that it was very, like, policy was designed without the dancers in mind, that we hadn't properly been consulted, that the policy was designed to appease the voices of the radical feminist left who wanted to shut the places down, and it was also designed to kind of keep the club owners essentially happy, and there was this kind of happy medium, but at no point was this issue of working conditions and employment law ever addressed. They never went near it. They didn't go near it. So what happened was, the Policing and Crime Act was a new law. It gave local authorities the power to decide how many licences they give out. There's completely different licensing regime kind of objectives. So where a public entertainment license, like, people can't object on certain grounds, well, they still can't object to a strip club on moral grounds, but they can object to on a whole load of other grounds, like I was saying, the proximity to a school or a church or a residential area.
I remember that one from years back.
Yeah, so it's kind of, you know, now the industry is very much kind of, the only way it's regulated is by local authorities deciding, thinking about, like, the wider social impact that strip clubs have. So one of the things that they've banned is advertising. Clubs can't advertise themselves from the outside, like, you know, they've got to be quite discreet, like, they can't have kind of like new girls here, like, it's got to be just kind of, you know, a name.
John Bouts, all the rage, all the rage. On Trax FM.
Yeah.
So the wider social impact thing is another story. Mm. But that's what's kind of taken over as like the main priority in terms of how this industry is controlled, right?
Mm. It seems really like that no one consulted the workers on this.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So, hence starting the East London Strippers Collective. I moved down to London in 2010. I found myself working in a place called the White Horse in Shoreditch, which is closed now, sadly, but it was a family-run business for 38 years. It certainly wasn't the best place. It wasn't perfect. There were still elements of the way that place was run that were quite old school, quite harsh, quite, you know, we didn't have employment protections, but there was a fairness. So the woman that ran it had a kind of understanding of not having too many girls working in competition with each other. I should say, by the way, that one of the effects of the Licensing Act, sorry, the Policing and Crime Act, one of the direct consequences has been that handing the power to local authorities to decide, you know, how many licenses and how many clubs are allowed open, it had a massive impact. Like, suddenly the industry shrunk overnight. A lot of licenses were revoked. A lot of places were found to not have the right licenses. There was a big battle in Hackney at the time. With Hackney were the first council in the country to try and implement the law, and actually they attempted to shut down all the clubs, but there was a big fuss made, and some of the clubs were allowed to remain open because of grandfather laws and stuff. And what that meant in practice is that you suddenly had a load of women put out of work. You suddenly had a shortage of like work to go around, and that increases then the levels of competition and toxicity among workers. So if we're self-employed, we don't get paid a wage.
No.
So we're all hustling. So, you know, suddenly we find like there's less clubs to choose from. The ones that remain open have kind of a monopoly on essentially the way they run. No one's done anything about the fees and the fines and the commissions and all that kind of exploitation. So the clubs have just put their fees up. And of course, the clubs that now have to operate under a sexual entertainment license, well, a sexual entertainment license is a lot more expensive than a public entertainment license. And it's a lot harder to keep hold of. And you have to be able to like provide showers and you know they've got to demonstrate that they've kind of fulfilled their sort of obligations. So if they've got to go and build a fucking shower for us, who do you think they're going to make pay for that?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's a club in Scotland, the Great Western. They were the last club in the country to ever charge dancers to work, right? And guess why? Because the local authority made them put in showers. The only way, it's a tiny venue, the only way they could do that was by excavating down under the bar into the ground by putting in a cellar, building the showers. The place was shut for like 6 months. They lost, you know, hundreds of thousands in revenue. Who do you think fucking pays for it? So that was the first, that was, like I say, the last place in the country to start charging dancers to work.
Yeah.
And that's just exactly the kind of poor forethought, you know, it's not been thought out. They've certainly not looked at the actual business model and how we're going to be affected.
Yeah, but they've got their cart before their horse there, because number one thing would be to protect, in my mind anyway, would protect you as workers' rights so that you can't be charged for something like the business wants to build something new.
For sure, you'd
and
have thought that, wouldn't
go,
you?
Go, by the way, you need, if you really still want to pursue that, go, you need to build showers and you're fucking paying for it, and don't even think of charging your employees for it.
You would think that.
Yeah.
And frankly, the amount of hysteria and kind of nonsensical kind of conversation at a sort of, you know, policy level around issues like strip clubs and sex work is outrageous. I mean, for an example,
yeah,
what's happening in New York right now, a year ago they passed a rule that in order to limit, again, this is about limiting the wider social impact, they've passed a law, it's called the 60-40 law, strip clubs must now, if they want to remain open as a strip club, they must now change their business model so that 60% of their revenue comes from not stripping. It must come from like a different source, so like a restaurant. So they're saying, like, if you change your business so that 60% of your revenue is coming from serving food, then you can remain in this residential area.
Okay.
So that's the way, that's, you know, how to solve a labour issue, how to solve a labour conditions issue. Make them serve food. Excellent. Yeah, yeah, really cool. Well thought out. Like, this is, and this, I think this leads me on to the next conversation, which is this word called whorephobia, and, you know, let's talk a bit about that.
Okay. I was just going to say, can I have some potato wedges and lap dogs, please?
There is actually a strip club in Portland, Oregon.
Mm.
It's called, I think, Diablo or something. And it's the only vegan strip club in the world. And unfortunately, their tagline is, the only meat is on the pole. Which very much undermines what they're trying to do.
You started
there.
So well.
Exactly. Exactly. But it's almost like they've just immediately just kind of like fucked themselves by making themselves sound like the grossest club in the world.
Love animals, hate women.
Yeah. Exactly. So let's talk about women hating. Let's talk about whorephobia. Have you ever heard that word before?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I'm familiar with concepts like misogyny, but I don't think I've ever heard it called whorephobia. Or maybe I have.
Whorephobia is, I think, a little bit different to misogyny. Misogyny you could just simply describe as kind of woman hating and sort of fear of the womb and the uterus and fear of female sexuality. Whorephobia is a bit more like... So it's whorephobia would look like one woman judging another woman for having different boundaries. Whorephobia looks like a stripper who says, oh yeah, but I'm not an escort. Or it looks like an escort saying, oh yeah, but I don't work on the street. Or it's a phone operator saying, oh yeah, but I don't have to touch clients. Or, you know, so when whorephobia exists within the sex industry, that's called the whorearchy. So there's this kind of, you know, an attempt to bypass stigma by just kind of passing it on to someone else, which definitely doesn't help our cause. It definitely, that's a major obstacle to what we're trying to achieve within the wider movement. I'll talk about the wider movement later. Mm. So, you know, that what sex workers as a group are trying to achieve globally, which is decriminalisation. But whorephobia is all over the place. Whorephobia, we see it in like the pole fitness community with the hashtag not a stripper. It's like when, you know, people are very much trying to just kind of distance themselves from women who use their sexuality for a living, you know, for capital or for personal benefit. And there's a long history, we're talking like thousands of years, like, you know, millennia of basically, you know, sex workers, women being demonized and stigmatized and just shut out of society and not having a stake in society. Mm. But then we've sort of seen like where the sex industry booms and, you know, people can grow rich from it, we need to make sure that at the heart of what goes on, and particularly at a policy level, that policy is designed around the people who are most affected, which is actually the workers, first of all. And yeah, of course, I'm not saying, you know, local residents don't get to have a say about, you know, what goes on in their vicinity, but it's like, you know, where moralism dominates the conversation, we've still got a major problem.
Yeah, that moralism is very, it bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially from a culture that invented the carry-on film. I mean, it's just very, it's extraordinarily self-righteous, it's massively hypocritical, and it should have died out about a century and a half ago, if it ever should have lived in the first place.
Yeah, I guess the point is that the moralism is around, I guess, the fear of... what was I going to say? So wider social impact is to do with this fear of, like, a spreading. Mm. Like, something's going to spread. Like, it's going to get out of control. And the thing about strip clubs is they have become some of the most, probably the most visible elements of the sex industry, yeah?
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily know who's a sex worker. Like, sex work goes on all the time, all over the place, in flats, in hotels, in private, you know, it's between consenting adults. The thing about a strip club is that's a kind of a space, and it's a space that straddles between the kind of public and the private. So it's a public space in that it's a licensed premises, but it's private in that it's a licensed premises. And so there's this query of like a question mark over kind of how much consent is going on. Now, the thing is, for sex work to happen safely, we need those spaces which are not necessarily regulated, but are safe. So the whole the main objective now for sex workers is decriminalisation, because we very much demand the right to create our own working conditions. And this is where what strippers are trying to do at the moment links up with what sex workers are trying to do at the moment, which is give us the power to decide what happens to us. And the state has failed. You know, the licensing authorities have failed. If they ever had a duty of care to us to protect us from financial exploitation and all the victimisation and the harassment and the abuse and the violence that happens.
And all the stuff that, you know, worker legislation is there for.
Yeah, exactly. They have failed. So now we're going in saying, you know, with the union, with United Voices of the World, we're now beginning a campaign where we're going in and we're saying, no, we're workers, actually. We are workers, and these are our rights. And we want to have our industry redesigned around that as at the heart of it. At the moment, what it's designed around is this moralistic, wider social impact, what effect it has on women outside. And there's so much spurious research done about this. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's been debunked about, you know, how much impact the opening of a strip club has on, like, violence, domestic violence within a 5-mile radius and stuff like that. Very spurious stuff, but it's, you know, when the research actually stacks up, it's found that the opening of an off license has more impact on domestic violence.
Football matches
have a devastating effect on domestic violence. So, you know, and now, of course, we've got this thing creeping in called the Nordic model, which is legislation designed to sound like they're, you know, taking a softer approach on the workers, which is, oh, we're not going to criminalise the workers anymore, but we're going to criminalise the punters.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, all the evidence in the countries where they've gone for the Nordic model, all the testimonial evidence coming out of the industry is that it's not solved any problems, and it's just driven, all that's done is driven away the quality clients, the safe clients, and the people who are willing to break the law are the remaining kind of leftover clients.
John Bouts, all the rage. On Trax FM. Trax FM.
Love our bunkers, bring your friends.
think, you know, where policy fails to follow evidence, it lets people down. If you can compare this to like drugs policy, you know, countries like Portugal, like Switzerland, that have decriminalized drugs and they've turned it into a public health issue and they are treating it as a public health issue, the evidence is there. The evidence is there that it is better, that it's better for society. So sex workers are able to access healthcare, resources, support. They can go to the police if things go wrong, and the police will actually, you know, go after the perpetrator and not be, you know, kind of investigating the sex worker as some kind of wrongdoer. Amsterdam's an interesting case. I mean, in the Netherlands, so there's different ways of you've got legalization, sorry, you've got criminalization, you've got legalization, you've got partial decriminalization, and then you've got full decriminalization. The thing about legalization is that's essentially the way the strip club industry is run here in the country, in the UK at the moment. Okay. It's legalized and it's licensed. And so the state has control over how things are done. And it essentially puts the state in the role of pimp. You see what I mean? They're taking their license fees and they're calling the shots. And what we're seeing in Netherlands now is that they are. I mean, the red light district is at risk. You know, a lot of places are being shut down. It is being gentrified. They've put the costs, the rents up of renting a window. So, I mean, I was just in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago and I was kind of walking around the red light district on a Friday night seeing all these empty windows for rent. I was like, really? Like, what's going on here? When the state has all the power, then it becomes like a zoning issue. So then you have like the red light district, so we're going to put all the sex workers in this one place, and we're going to, by the way, also put all the coffee shops there and all the pubs there, and we're just going to basically put all of that shit together in the one place where we can sort of control it,
the vice center, if you like.
And so what do you imagine happens then, that in time, if you're, you know, a sex worker working in this kind of area where it's like, ooh, lads, and you know, that has a devastating impact. Along the confusion is that there are victims of the sex industry. There are people who've been, you know, raped and abused, and there are girls who've entered the industry underage and, you know, who've been coerced and who've basically been trafficked. Like, that's all real. That's all real. We accept that. The reason that's happened is they didn't have protection. And what does protection look like? It looks like safe spaces. It looks like mechanisms. It looks like legislation. It looks like... And it, am I not?
Yeah, I think you're right. But the what bothers me, and I can't help but say this, is I think, and I'm thinking back to the fella whose name I don't remember, and fuck him, his name doesn't deserve to be remembered, who was murdering prostitutes around Leeds and places like...
Peter Sutcliffe.
Oh, no, after him, the one a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, Leeds.
And what this is actually about that bothers me most is that addressing the needs of people who work in the sex industry and things around it involves you recognising that they're human.
Yeah.
And that they're workers.
Yeah.
And that they're not this weird aberration of unmoralistic, you know... creature from somewhere else.
When you go into a strip club, you pay your fee, yeah, okay, you know, you get ripped off financially, but then you are then in control of how you're seen. You then walk around the club and you speak to customers, and if they treat you like shit, you can talk back.
Yeah.
If they swear at you, you can swear back. If if you don't like them, you don't have to speak to them. And the thing about live performance is it's actually humanizing in its very like nature. Like, it's not no one is kind of actually objectified if they are a real human, like walking, talking, speaking, behave, you know what I mean? So I think what happens then is that the wider kind of public, they think that what happens in strip clubs, they think what they know comes from this two-dimensional media. So that kind of objectification is then transferred onto us. Do you see what I mean? So we kind of become then a sort of victim of a type of objectification that we didn't necessarily choose. Because, you know, like strippers in films, strippers on TV, strippers on, you know, fucking EastEnders. Like, it's, that's not what we are about.
I mean, I think the problem is, I just wish blokes would have more of a, like, if you might very well have a feeling of, like, I'm not entirely sure I'm totally happy with my girlfriend is, but that's your problem. And you need to work on that and get over it.
I think adult human beings have the right to negotiate their own boundaries and where, you know, where we get let down, I think, is where, like, the state either supports or undermines that right, you know?
Yeah.
So, for example, if I want to be a sex worker, but I operate in a kind of criminalised, you know, in a culture where that is criminalised, that's going to have an effect on my relationship. That's going to make the negotiation of those boundaries more difficult than they necessarily would be if it was legal or, you know, decriminalised. Like, if I can go to my partner and say, well, you know, this is what I'm doing for a living, and these are the risks, and these are the benefits, well, you know, if the list of risks is bigger than the list of benefits, then you know that's going to make that negotiation with your partner a lot harder.
Well, yeah, and because like you say, with illegality, how far does that illegality go? Because is it going to threaten your house of residence? Is your landlord going to kick you out if he finds out you're doing this? You've got all of those things to think about.
The criminalisation aspect of sex work is, I believe, a reflection of some of the worst failures of state kind of responsibility. I mean, for sex workers to lose their children, to have their children taken away from them, for them to be three times more likely to be misdiagnosed at hospital, if if they can't talk about their job, or B, because they don't want to, or C, because their doctor is going to be homophobic and just dismissive. Things like, you are more likely to be investigated by the police. If you call the cops because you've been robbed or something's happened to you, they're more likely to start investigating you. Like housing, working with children, you know, the being criminalised can have a devastating effect on someone's life, devastating. And I've just heard so many horror stories, like raids happening in brothels where girls are being arrested, having their passports confiscated, being told, come back when you've got a ticket to leave the country and you get your passport back. Well, how do you think they're then going to go and make that money?
Exactly.
So you've effectively, the police have then put them in the position of having to work to pay for a ticket to leave the country. It's despicable. I'm not the best source of information, but I recommend to your listeners to go to sites like the English Collective of Prostitutes, prostitutescollective.net, SWARM, which stands for the Sex Workers Advocacy and Resistance Movement, Extort Project, Release, Basis Yorkshire, National Ugly Mugs, what are the other big ones? Scott Pep. Have I missed any?
We can always put them at the end.
There are organisations which are doing stellar activism. They are pulling all this stuff out. They are documenting these stories. They are getting these testimonies down and, you know, getting them out there. And I think this is starting to just about begin to, you know, change the conversation. I think, like, we're only just starting to see glimmers of a change in social attitudes, because, I mean, I just noticed on EastEnders the other week there was a character who one of the dudes calls her a brass, and she's like, I'm a sex worker actually, and that's pretty radical for EastEnders. But it goes to show, I think, you know, when you see EastEnders starting to catch up, you think, oh, there's some hope there.
All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.